Didn't see duty. Emergency duty. Okay, guys. I get to talk to her when Blau comes in, or Ellie gives me a hatchet job. Okay, so we're introducing this week's parsha to Moshe Rabbeinu, who dominates the entire remaining section of the Torah. We spoke a lot in Sefer Bereishis about Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but this is clearly the Ish Elokim. And we're interested in how this person emerges as such an impressive leader. And we mentioned in Parshas Lech Lecha the complete vacuum of information regarding Avraham, that the Torah wants to cast Avraham's mission and Avraham's selection as the story of every man. Not to assume that it takes an Avraham and a career of Avraham to be selected. Hashem selects all of us. But unlike Avraham, Moshe's background is provided. But it's provided with a twist, because you'd expect the background information of Moshe to be very spiritual, about his religious sensibility, about his encounter with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And it's not the Moshe we see. And we don't have enough time to discuss the Moshe we see, but Vateros El Kitovu, we see moral character, sensitivity, compassion, moral indignation. And that's the baseline of religious identity is moral goodwill and moral commitment. And that leads Moshe Rabbeinu to this encounter with Hashem and Har Elokim. But we also see Moshe's background through the prism of these two godmothers of Moshe. Moshe doesn't really have... he has a natural mother, but her identity is sublimated or suppressed, even when we'd expect it to surface. So Moshe is the product of this union, or reunion, as Chazal tell us. But the identity of Moshe's mother is suppressed, in part to highlight the identity of his two godmothers. Who are Moshe's two godmothers? Well, one is the person who actually retrieves him from the water and endows him with his name, Moshe Rabbeinu, Bas Paro. But one of them is his sister. Why is Miriam Moshe's godmother? Because there are two interactions between Miriam and Moshe, one before Moshe's born, but that's absolutely crucial to Moshe being born, and one after he's born. And we'll just discuss them very briefly because they highlight two different traits of leadership and two different traits of the not the genetic background or baseline of Moshe, but the existential and experiential background of Moshe Rabbeinu. Chazal tell us, if you take a look at sources, anyone have a sheet? This is your sheet. So the Gemara in Selta tells us, where is he going? You see, not everyone has the sheet, so I'll paraphrase. It's a Gemara, it's a Medrash. Paro, of course, issues his decree. And it's according to this Medrash, the decree about children being flung into the Nile was already issued. At a certain point, Amram gets so depressed and so melancholy that he throws in the towel and he says, what purpose is there to sustaining this marriage? What purpose certainly is there to bringing new children into this nightmarish, crushing reality? And he separates from his wife Yocheved. Whether it's a legal separation or just a separation, each walking their own way, but it's clear that their marriage has been dismantled under the crushing weight of Paro's decree. And Miriam steps in, and Miriam chides her father. And Miriam says, Abba, Paro decreed against the males. You're essentially discriminating against all Jewish population growth because by ceasing from this marriage, withdrawing, you are preventing any population growth and you're a leader and people are taking their example from you and this is contagious and if you separate from Ima, then perhaps others will follow suit. So she encourages her father, despite the ridiculous, almost preposterous nature of bringing children to this world, to advance. And that encouragement and that intercession yields the birth of Moshe, the redemption of Am Yisrael, the reversal of history, the delivery of Ish Elokim and Torah Hashem and Har Sinai. And it reminds us that Jews sometimes face, and people, not just Jews, but people sometimes face very, very discouraging realities. And sometimes we can't appreciate or understand the larger calculus of those realities. And our responsibility is just to maintain moral conviction, moral fiber, to toe the line, to maintain our own resolve. Sometimes I used to ask on interviews, I used to ask boys, if you can go back to one period in Jewish history, which period would you want to go back to? Because obviously I want to gauge not just how much Torah you're interested in absorbing and your middos, but also who are you as a Jew, because your Jewish identity is so crucial to your Torah identity. And that's a good way to wrap your head around that question. I remember once on an interview, and the answers are pretty frequent. I get Har Sinai, Kriyas Yamsuf, the State of Israel. At one point, a boy turned the tables on me and said, Rebbe, where would you want to go back to? I said, this kid has moxie. He's definitely accepted. And he's sitting in this room right now. Okay, I got everyone's attention. Okay. I saw some people pick their heads up. And I'll tell you his identity. And it's Rabbi Blount. And so he asked me that question. Where would I want to go back in Jewish history? I said, quite honestly, I'd want to go back and stand next to the people who survived Auschwitz and walked out of Auschwitz alive. Because what was the first thing many of them did? We read about it. First thing many of them did was to find a sister and the sister's friend or a niece or someone from the village and a brother's friend. Just remarry and rebuild their families. And little did they know that the children born in 1946, 1947, 48, 49 would march in the fields of redemption and be pioneers of the rebirth of our state. They couldn't see what we see in hindsight. Are you kidding? A chance to fight in the Independence War, a chance to stand as the new state is flowering? They didn't see that. And the moral courage and valor that it must have taken those people to bring children into an erstwhile nightmarish world. How could you bring a child into a post-Holocaust world of refugees and destruction and financial disrepair and familiar? But that's not how we process. We maintain our moral responsibilities, and sometimes they don't make sense in the larger historical trends and currents in the torrents of history. But there has to be a part of you that just maintains simple, basic moral and religious commitment, even when they don't seem to accord with the larger forces that may be a part of it. You hear this in Miriam's vision. Abba, she says, I understand your frustration. I understand your despondence. It seems futile. But you do yours and let HaKadosh Baruch Hu do his. You can't always calculate larger factors and larger concerns. And you're married. You're a leader. People are impressionable. They're looking for commitment and resilience and tenacity. And you are broadcasting cowardice, retreat, forfeiting marriage. I don't know where this is heading, but Abba, you have to take Yima back. And no one could imagine that this slight intervention changes history. This is a history-changing moment. So sometimes we think of history-changing and difference-making in broad, dramatic, and epic sweeps, and people that grab headlines and turn the world on its axis. And sometimes you just change history by dispensing with your simple moral responsibilities, even in the face of unenviable and seemingly irrepressible odds. You follow through on halachic and moral responsibilities, even when you can't see how there will be altering. I mean, just think about major history-altering activity over the last two generations, where a few Soviet Jews in Moscow decided to defy the Soviet Empire and the Soviet machinery that was geared towards suppressing and snuffing out Jewish identity. And do they even know? Imagine if you interview Natan Sharansky and you interview Yuli Edelstein, they know this would lead to the fall of the Soviet Empire, would lead to the mass immigration of 1.5 million Jews, a game changer in the state of Israel. They just knew they were Jewish, and they wanted to express the Jewish identity, and those who were of religious minds wanted to fulfill their commitments to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and little acts changed the world. We're living in an era of broad headlines and sweeping attention grabbers and just simple little acts of defiance and of moral fortitude and moral conviction. And now it's a little bit later. And it's 3 months later, probably more than 3 months. It's a good 12 months later. Moshe's been born. Amram is reunited with Yocheved. Moshe's been born. He's been hidden for 3 months. And at this point, his concealment becomes unsustainable. So he has to be thrown into the Nile River. And to a degree, the Medrash tells us Amram turns to Miriam and starts scoffing at her vision. You see where your vision landed you. I've borne a child just to be fodder for crocodiles. And Moshe is placed into the Nile. And at this point, he has a second encounter with Miriam. His first that he's alive, but his second experiential encounter. Where Miriam walks to the river, and the language of the pasuk is, Vatesatzav achoso merachok l'de'a mayaselo. She stands by the Nile River. Why is this important? How is she helping the scene? How is she helping Moshe's rescue? She's going to scope Bas Paro. She'll text or tweet that Moshe's in the river. Someone come grab him. What is her standing by the Nile River? How is that in any way relevant, helpful? Why is it recorded? In fact, the Medrash in Parshas Bishalach, when she leads Am Yisrael's response and the women's response, Vatan Lahem Miriam Shir Lashem Ki Go Ga'ah, Chazal say that she was a Navi. How do we know she was a Navi? She was one of the Naviim. one of the only female Nevi'ot. How do we know she was a Navi? Chazal point back to this pasuk, Vateisatzav. Ein yitziva ela nevuah. So I think what's happening in Miriam's instance is as follows. When we think of chesed, we think of it in very, very practical terms. People suffer. People are in states of distress, and we can alleviate or ameliorate their condition. So we try our hardest for the various reasons that we've enumerated in this year. To alleviate people's suffering, to be like a Kodesh Baruch Hu, to create firm and sustainable societies. But sometimes you can't really change people's lives, and you can't really alleviate their suffering. But you can sympathize with them and just stand with them and make them appreciate that you're standing side by side and identifying with what they're going through. I remember at the Beis HaAvel a few nights ago, at Erez Orbach's Shiva, you know, Erez was killed last Sunday in that ramming attack, and there were hordes of people coming through, and many of them didn't know. And the father wisely just told people, he says, some of you have stories to share, some of you have comments to make, some of you are easing my pain with your share, anecdotes about my son, or telling me where you come from, or people came in from the United States, and that gave me tremendous, tremendous support and consolation. He says, if some of you are just coming, you have nothing to say, don't be awkward about it. Just the fact that you're sitting in this room and you've taken your valuable time and you're sitting next to me and sitting in this room and showing me your support, that makes me know that we're one family and that you care and that you care enough to take the time out. What's Miriam doing? Absolutely nothing. But how do you turn your back on your little brother as he's floating down the Nile River until you absolutely can't see him anymore? And you absolutely can't provide any assistance or any sympathy or any identification. And then you turn away because there's no more purpose just to looking at an empty river. The story my wife told me that I'm very fond of sharing, and I hope we'll get to the end. If not, I'll share it some other time. She's a physical therapist for neurologically disabled children. And neurologically disabled children are oftentimes vision impaired. One feeds the other. If you can't walk, then your vision is stunted. And if you can't see, then it's harder for you to walk. So vision and walking and vision and emotion are all intertwined. So in her place of work, she has a vision therapist who gauges the vision capacity of the patients, of the children, and calibrates treatment appropriately. How much can the child see? Let's calibrate the treatment. So the vision therapist told my wife the following story. She said, children who are born with sight and lose it are able to appreciate and understand, able to internalize they no longer have sight. You had a sensory perception, you no longer have it, now we'll reorient your experience based on the absence of this sense. What about children who are born blind? At what point do these children realize they lack the faculty of sight? So the vision therapist told my wife that basically when children are 7 or 8, they start to be able to abstract and compare their experiences to other people's experiences. Until then, you live in your own social container. When you're 6, 7, 8, you start to compare and contrast. So at 6, 7, or 8, she counsels parents of children who are born blind about how to break the news to their child and ease them into the transition into a healthy life. So this vision therapist told my wife of the following very precocious girl who was 5 years old, was born blind, and was sitting with her mother one Friday night in the living room waiting for the father to come home from shul. And the little girl told her mother, Ima, where's Abba? Where's Abba? And the mother said, I don't know, let me go to the window and see if he's walking home. And at that point, the little girl asks her mother, Ima, what does it mean to see if Abba's coming home? I don't know what that means. What does it mean to see? I just don't understand it. To see if Abba's coming home? So the mother knew the moment was upon her, and she was completely unprepared for that moment. She was expecting it to happen at 7 or 8. Here she's with her 5-year-old daughter, forced to confront this challenge, to say the least. So she sits down next to her daughter and she says, I want to explain something to you. Hashem gave you so many gifts. You're beautiful. You're smart. You have a wonderful family. You are healthy. There's something called seeing with your eyes. Touch your eyes. And Hashem didn't give you that gift. Other people have that gift. Hashem didn't give you that gift. But you have so many talents and so many gifts. You'll be great. You'll be fine. You'll have a very, very successful life. She did a good job under the circumstances, the mother. At this point, the little girl starts screaming at the top of her lungs, Ima, I hate you. I hate Hashem. How could he do this to me? How could he not give me this son? I'll never see anything. She starts screaming and shrieking at the top of her lungs. And the mother is overwhelmed. She sits there, what's she going to do? So she climbs into bed with her 5-year-old daughter, and she starts crying with her. Rabbi Blau is about to walk in, but let me tell you the punchline. After 20 minutes, the little girl tells her mother, Ima, one more sentence. I now know that everything will be all right, not because of anything you told me, but because you cried with me. When you're crying with me, I know that you now can feel what I'm going through. And you can connect that to me standing by the Nile River, but by Blau, please.